This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Humanity is in the hot seat. Today, the World Meteorological Organization and the European Commission's Copernicus Climate Change Service are releasing official data that confirms that July 2023 is set to be the hottest month ever recorded in human history. We don't have to wait for the end of the month to know this. Short of a mini ice age over the next days, July 2023 will shatter records across the board. According to the data released today, July has already seen the hottest three-week period ever recorded, the three hottest days on record, and the highest ever ocean temperatures for this time of year. The consequences are clear and they are tragic. Children swept away by monsoon rains, families running from the flames, workers collapsing in scorching heat. For vast parts of North America, Asia, Africa, and Europe, it's a cruel summer. For the entire planet, it is a disaster. And for scientists, it is unequivocal. Humans are to blame. All this is entirely consistent with predictions and repeated warnings. The only surprise is the speed of the change. Climate change is here, it is terrifying, and it is just the beginning. The era of global warming has ended, the era of global boiling has arrived. The air is unbreathable, the heat is unbearable, and the level of fossil fuel profits and climate inaction is unacceptable. Leaders must lead. No more hesitancy, no more excuses, no more waiting for the others to move first. There is simply no more time for that.
That was Secretary General Antonio Guterres at the UN July 27, 2023. U.S. President Joe Biden called a rare press event about the amazing heat blasting the U.S. South and now East. Maybe the leaders are finally taking some heat themselves. The world record hottest ocean temperature was just measured off Florida. The Mediterranean just set a new heat record. A rural area of China set a blistering new heat high never seen before in that country with 52.2 degrees Celsius, 126 degrees Fahrenheit in the shade. Billions of people are suffering through long-lasting heat waves around all the northern hemisphere. Something strange is happening. Nobody saw this coming. I'm Alex Smith. This week we have two new guest interviews and a fast report on the weird weather on Greenland from the world's best, Jason Box.
Radio EcoShock.
Just as billions of people suffer through the world's first record round-the-planet heat wave, American writer Jeff Goodell strikes with his new book. It's called The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. Jeff's book is already on the New York Times bestseller list. We last talked with Goodell after his 2017 book, The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. That was a New York Times critic's top book of 2017. Often published in Rolling Stone magazine, Jeff is a journalist's journalist. Jeff Goodell, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
I was going to say, what are the odds your heat book lands during a record heat wave? But in 2023, I guess the odds were pretty good. Still, you must be stunned by what is happening with the global heat these days.
Yeah, it's a little strange and a little eerie, having spent 4 years writing this book and having it coming out at the same moment as we have this global heat wave. It feels a little bit like I'm living in my own Stephen King novel. but, you know, I wrote this book because I understood, as anybody would who thought much about this, that our planet was getting hotter and hotter as we continue to burn fossil fuels, and that dealing with heat, both in a personal way and a kind of planetary way, it was going to become more and more urgent of an issue.
So what caused you, though, to shift your focus from rising seas to heat?
Well, it actually, you know, began very at a very sort of simple and clear moment for me. I happened to be in Arizona, in Phoenix, in 2019. I had some meetings there for a different climate story I was working on, and I took a walk downtown to one of these meetings on I think the temperature was about 115 degrees, and I had to walk about 12 blocks. And by the time I got to the end of the 12 blocks, my heart was pounding, and I was feeling a little dizzy, and I realized, oh, my gosh, this heat is incredible. And I'd never really thought about what that heat meant to a human body and how easy it was, how dangerous it was, and what the risks were. And it was sort of surprising to me because I'd been, by that time, writing about climate change for more than a decade. I knew all about, you know, obviously about global warming and the impacts of warmth, but I had never really thought about heat. And the book was really born of that moment.
So what is heat, really? We can't see it. We can't hear it. We can't directly smell it. What is it?
That's an interesting question, and it's one that I sort of thought about in the aftermath of that moment walking on the streets in Phoenix when I realized that even though I had been a climate journalist for a long time, I couldn't describe what heat was. You know, I obviously knew what temperature was, as we all do, but heat, what is heat itself? And it turns out there is a big question in the history of science. There was a lot of debate in the 18th and 19th centuries about, you know, what actually heat is, and was it an invisible wave? Was it some kind of fluid? The word calorie actually comes out of this idea, this caloric theory that hypothesized it was this invisible fluid that moved between objects. But the short version of it is what heat is vibration. When something is hotter, the molecules vibrate faster. And when we touch a hot coffee cup or a hot steering wheel or something, what's happening is the molecules in that steering wheel or the coffee cup are vibrating faster. And that energy, that vibration is transferred to the molecules on our fingertips, which our brains register as heat.
You know, I talked with a doctor in Hawaii who found 27 different ways that heat can kill people in the body, reactions from organs to all sorts of things. And in 2004, a killer heat wave in Europe killed about 70,000 people. And I was shocked to see a new report just came out recently that 62,000 deaths in the EU were attributed to heat in last year, 2022. Do we know, Jeff, how many people are killed by heat around the world?
No, we do not. And we don't, and I would argue, after talking to many public health officials around the world, not only do we not have any kind of precise figure, we don't even really have a good idea. When you talk about kind of global heat mortality statistics, most of Africa is not even included. And obviously, lots of people die in Africa from extreme heat, just as they do in the rest of the world, but there's simply no accounting. And, you know, in addition to that, heat is not like a gun. It doesn't leave a wound that you can say, oh, that's where the bullet went in. This person died of a gunshot. With heat, people who die of heat stroke often die first. What first happens is their heart goes out because of the stress that dealing with heat puts on their hearts. And so they, by one definition, they died of a heart attack. And it's only when you consider the context with which that heart attack happened that you understand that it was really driven by extreme heat. So these mortality numbers and these statistics are just a kind of vague outline of what we're dealing with.
Well, for once and for all, are some races or bodies adapted to the heat? Are they able to work outside safely when others cannot? What did you find?
No. The answer to that is no. Yeah, that was a big issue during the 19th century, during slavery. There was this idea that black people evolved in Africa and that they were somehow better equipped for heat. So they're working in the cotton field during these really hot days. It didn't impact them the way it impacted, you know, other people. We see remnants of that here in Texas where I live, where there's a lot of Mexican workers who are working on road crews and construction crews. There's this sort of unspoken idea that it doesn't affect them as much. Not true. One of the things that I found in reporting this book is there is different vulnerability to heat depending on, like, how old you are, how strong your heart is. Body shape can have an impact. You know, taller, slender people generally do better than heavier, shorter people. And there are other factors, like if you're taking medications and things like that. But there's no genetic difference between someone who has comes from ancestry in Africa or someone who comes from ancestry in Canada. We're dealing with heat. We have the same cooling system. We have the same number of sweat glands. We all suffer from extreme heat.
And I find judging heat by the number of human deaths is misleading, as you say, partly because nobody really counts the heat deaths as such. But many governments also adapt with cooling centers and all that, so heat deaths might actually go down in one region, even as temperatures go up, until the grid goes down. And in your book you write, I just want to read this one sentence, if the blackout continues for more than 36 hours or so, it's likely the National Guard will need to be called in to maintain order and control widespread looting and general mayhem. What do you base that on? Is that mainly an American experience, or what do you think?
Well, I mean, that's, first of all, that whole passage about the consequences of a blackout during an extreme heat event come from a conversation I had with an infrastructure expert at University of Arizona who had thought a lot about this. But, you know, the kind of ongoing chaos of what happens during a blackout is, there's plenty of evidence of that during blackouts in history, you know, blackouts in New York City, you know, riots, looting, all kinds of things like that. There's lots of historic sort of evidence of that. But, you know, what's not widely appreciated is how vulnerable we are. We think that we are people who live in hot places, like I'm talking to you from Austin, Texas, where it's a very hot place. You know, we had a 5-day blackout here in the middle of winter, you know, a couple of years ago. And because it's Texas and not, you know, northern Canada, still a number of people died. It wasn't as bad as it could have been. But if that kind of 5-day blackout happened here on an extreme heat week like we're having right now, you know, people's air conditioning would go out. There would be a lot of death. There would be a lot of suffering. It would be catastrophic in a very obvious and profound way. You know, our houses are not built with natural ventilation in mind. We had this idea that air conditioning can protect us, and when the power goes out, that doesn't happen.
Well, let's go back to Phoenix as a case study. The city had almost a month where the daily high was at least 110 degrees Fahrenheit in the shade, 43 degrees C. The nighttime heat didn't go below 90 degrees or 32 C. And in fact, Phoenix set a new record all-time nighttime low for the United States at 97 degrees Fahrenheit, the coldest they had that particular night. Oh, my God. That's punishing, and it's extra dangerous if it keeps going with no low night times to cool people off, isn't it?
That's right. That's a really important point that a lot of people don't grasp, you know, because dealing with heat is strenuous for our body. You know, the way that our bodies deal with heat is by, you know, our heart pumping faster to move our blood away from our internal organs and out towards the surface of our skin so that it can be cooled by sweating. And that's the mechanism that our body uses. And within a certain temperature range and, you know, as long as you're relatively healthy, it works pretty well. But even for normal healthy people in moderate conditions, it's a lot of extra strain. And when you don't have cooling off at night, usually if you do have cooling off at night, your body gets a break, everything gets to rest, and the stress on your body is reduced. But if you have high nighttime temperatures, especially if it's combined with any kind of particular vulnerability on your part of your body, whether it's because of a heart condition or drugs you're taking or whatever, it really becomes much more dangerous more quickly. It's just like, you know, going for a long walk or something, and when you get tired, not being able to stop and take a rest, and it gets much more difficult if you're not able to recover for these brief periods.
And I know lots of listeners are thinking, well, I don't live in Phoenix. And that's what I thought until the heat reached almost 50 degrees C, 122 Fahrenheit, right here in British Columbia, Canada. As we heat the planet, do you think a lot of cities could get like Phoenix?
Well, I think that a lot of cities are vulnerable to extreme heat waves that have never imagined that before. You know, what happened in the Pacific Northwest in 2021 was a textbook example of that, as you know better than I do. But the wonderfully temperate climate, no one imagined there could be temperatures of 50 C in British Columbia. And yet it happened. And, you know, it underscores one of the most important points of this whole conversation and understanding kind of where we're at climate-wise now, is that because of the amount of CO2 we've put into the atmosphere, which has changed the kind of atmospheric dynamics related to the temperature gradient between the equator and the poles, and it has changed the jet stream, and it's mucking around with a lot of the basic physics of our atmosphere. We're not going back to the climate that, you know, we grew up in. We're living in an entirely new climate, and what those rules are for this new climate are not at all clear. And that means that, you know, we can expect extreme events, whether heat waves are a classic example, but also extreme rainfall and things like that, in places that we didn't used to think about them happening. And kind of basically all bets are off. And as you saw in British Columbia and Washington State and in Oregon, when that heat wave hit, people didn't know what to do. People didn't understand how to react. Most houses don't have air conditioning. You know, they're really unprepared for it. And I think one of the lessons of my book is that we need to be prepared. Everybody needs to be prepared. It's not just a Texas or a Phoenix thing, you know, it's everyone.
And despite being water threatened and heat battered, more people are moving to Phoenix. How is that possible, and when does that end?
Well, that's a good question about when it ends. But, you know, people are driven to Phoenix for a lot of reasons, and same thing to Texas. You know, I moved here to Austin 4 years ago. I lived in upstate New York until then, in a much cooler and sort of more climate-friendly place, but I fell in love with a woman who lived here, and I wanted to be with her, and it was better to be in a hot place with the person that I cared about than being in a cooler place, you know, at a distance from her. So people's reasons for moving are, you know, very complex. Jobs, closeness to relatives. In the case of Phoenix, there's traditionally been a lot of relatively inexpensive real estate. There's been a lot of jobs companies have that have moved there because of that, big warehouses and stuff and factories in the surrounding region, lower tax rates, a lot of things like that. Plus, there's this general idea that, you know, people generally prefer warmer weather than cooler weather. I mean, you know, not everybody, but in general, that's true. People would like to be in a place where they can wear shorts every day and walk outside. And the thing that's changing, though, is these sort of nice warm temperatures are rapidly becoming dangerous temperatures. And there's a big difference between, you know, hanging out in Phoenix on a 95-degree day and hanging out in Phoenix on a 115-degree day.
But it seems like the first wave of heat deaths are really a social problem. Rich people turn up the AC. Their streets have lots of trees. Over 1 billion people don't have AC or can't afford to pay the electric bill if they did. Talk to us about heat and social justice, Jeff.
Well, that's a really important point. You know, heat is predatory. Heat preys on the most vulnerable in our population, whether it's people who are older and who are not in as good a physical health and therefore more vulnerable to the stress that heat puts on our bodies, or whether it's outdoor workers, agricultural workers. I wrote about the death of an agricultural worker in Oregon during the 2021 heat wave in the Pacific Northwest in my book. You know, delivery people, postal carriers, you know, roads crews, construction crews, all those people, which keep our society rolling and, you know, allow the rest of us to sit in our air-conditioned offices and do our work. All those people in the sort of outdoors are extremely vulnerable to these changes. And so are, you know, people who can't afford air conditioning, don't have access to air conditioning. You know, I spent some time in Phoenix in some of the poorer neighborhoods, and, you know, I remember sitting in an apartment with a woman on a very, very hot day, and, you know, she had an air conditioner in her house. It was an old one, and it was on a meter, and she was trying to decide whether she should put another $10 into it and cool her apartment down for a few more hours or whether she could afford that or not. And, you know, she was constantly arbitraging between having enough money to buy food and having enough money to run her air conditioner. So, you know, in the book, I really talk about this line between the cooled and the damned, that there really is a difference between those of us who can find refuge away from the heat and others who, for a variety of circumstances and reasons, can't. And heat makes that line very clear.
And Vancouver just built a zillion apartments and condos in downtown towers. The walls are made entirely of glass. And due to safety regulations, windows can only open 4 inches. It's about as heat unfriendly as you can imagine. Is it fair to say the invention of the air conditioner made us forget how to design heat-ready cities?
Yeah, it's absolutely fair to say that. I mean, in the book, I talk about air conditioning as a technology of forgetting. We knew how to do this, how to build buildings with natural air circulation, how to cool things off. You know, in the 16th century in the Middle East, in Iran and Iraq, you know, they were able to use wind towers, these like big chimneys that captured wind. And by using carefully designed wind circulation patterns throughout the buildings, they went down into a basement where there was cool water that would chill out the air and recycle it through the house. They built these sort of natural air conditioning systems that worked so well that they could actually make ice in the 16th century from this sort of natural circulation of air. But we've forgotten all about how to do that. And, you know, we throw up these buildings like the one you're talking about in Vancouver that are designed to be sealed up. They're designed to be airtight. In some ways, some of the, you know, efficiency standards work against any kind of idea of natural cooling because you want the building as tightly sealed as possible. And, you know, that works all well and good until the air conditioning fails. And then those kinds of buildings become convection ovens and very dangerous very quickly. You know, I had a conversation with a very famous architect a couple of weeks ago whose name I don't want to use because it was off the record. We were just having dinner together, a conversation, but I was complaining about air conditioning and building these types of buildings like the one you're talking about in Vancouver. And he said, well, we absolutely know how to build buildings that use natural air circulation. And, you know, we don't need to air condition these kinds of buildings. We can do it another way. But he said, you know, all of my clients demand air conditioning. They all demand that they can keep the temperature at exactly 72 or 71 degrees. They don't want to have to deal with any kind of variability, anything like that. They just want comfort. And, you know, that's really the heart of the problem.
And you literally went to the end of the Earth to witness this planet heating up. Tell us about your trip to Antarctica and key lessons there.
Well, I was very fortunate. I was able to go on this 7-week cruise. It was a joint effort between U.S. scientists and the British Antarctic Survey on a ship to West Antarctica to investigate what was happening or what is happening to a glacier called Thwaites Glacier, which is kind of an enormous glacier that is the cork in the wine bottle for the entire West Antarctic ice sheet, which if it melted, would just that one ice sheet itself would raise sea levels 10 feet. Around the world, which is, you know, basically catastrophic for virtually every coastal city. But I went down there to look at what even just small changes in heat, the implications of that. And what I found was, and what the scientists found out that I was on a trip with, was really, you know, kind of remarkable, because the short version of it is a change in the Southern Ocean temperature of 1 degree Fahrenheit, hardly perceptible, 1 degree, has changed the ice and water dynamics beneath these glaciers and allowed the ocean water to begin to melt underneath the glaciers and flow down under the glaciers, which is destabilizing these enormous glaciers from below, making them much more likely to kind of crack up like a giant tray of ice cubes and sort of fall into the Southern Ocean, this kind of idea of scientists call ice cliff collapse. It's just really important because I wanted to demonstrate that even small changes in temperature, which we think of as being inconsequential, you know, what's 1 degree in the ocean, can have enormous consequences for people thousands of miles away and for really how we think about our cities and where we can live and where we can't.
In your book, you ask a question weighing heavy on my own mind, quote, with today's level of warming, are there any breaks on the atmospheric system that prevent a heat wave beyond any we've experienced or imagined, end quote. What did you find?
Well, that's a really interesting question. You know, I was very curious with a simple question, which is, you know, how hot can it get? Climate models are very good and have been proven to be very good, even in these extreme conditions we're seeing right now, at charting out kind of general warming given a certain level of CO2 and everything. And the climate models have really proved themselves. But what they haven't been able to model so well is these sort of extreme events, you know, these extreme temperatures like you had in British Columbia in 2021. And what I wanted to know was, is there any physical limits on how extreme these heat waves can get right now with the amount of CO2 and everything we have in the atmosphere. So forgetting about whether we cut CO2 or add the CO2, just like right now where we are. You know, because we had a temperature jump in Antarctica of 70 degrees 2 years ago, above average down there. You know, if we had a temperature jump of, this is Fahrenheit, 70 degrees Fahrenheit, of that kind of thing in a place like Austin or Phoenix, that would just be, you know, absolutely catastrophic. And the answer to the question that I got from talking to the world's top scientists about this is we don't know what the upper limits are. They don't know what the upper limits are. There's no physical mechanism that says here's how hot it can get. They all said we're highly, virtually impossible to get a 70-degree jump. We're not going to get, you know, heat waves of 180 degrees in Phoenix or Austin anytime soon. But could we get, you know, a temperature of 52, 50, switching back to centigrade, 52, 53 in a place like Phoenix or Austin or Houston or one of these hot places? It's possible. And so that's really terrifying in the kind of world we're creating for ourselves where we don't know what the boundaries really are.
Well, this is one of the weird things, though. Millions of people in the American South are roasting day after day, and yet there's still a strong current of climate denialism there, and people saying, well, no, this is just nature. What can you do? What do you think it will take, Jeff Goodell, for the United States and the world to act as though the climate emergency is real?
Well, I don't think there's going to be a one wake-up moment. You know, I don't think there's going to be a time when the world – whatever the event is, whether it's a heat waves or hurricanes or whatever, droughts or whatever, there's not going to be, I don't think there's going to be a kind of mass awakening. I think that, you know, this is a long, hard slog. People are becoming more and more aware of it. You look at the polling and things, and the number of climate kind of deniers are staying more or less the same when you look at these polls, but the number of people who understand that the climate crisis is real and is happening, is growing, and, you know, that's all to the good. The problem is it's not growing fast enough, and the urgency of taking action is still really not there. There's a lot of doomerism. There's a lot of people who are beginning to say, you know, we're really screwed. This is evidence that we're really screwed. This is hopeless. There's nothing we can do. You know, I'm just going to hang out in my basement and wring my hands about the future of human civilization. I think the doomerism is also very dangerous. And, you know, what it will take to kind of inspire the kind of political action that we need, which is really what we're talking about now. The economics of clean energy are so clear. The economics of adaptation are so clear. We need more dramatic political action right now, and that's what we're still lacking, is that kind of political leadership.
Wrapping up, your book suggests we don't really know heat, and you offer stories to help understand. Is that fair? And why do you say the heat will kill you first?
Well, you know, I understand that it's a controversial title, but I really wanted to call the name for this to be the title of the book for two reasons. One is that when you look at other climate impacts, it's really heat that is the most dangerous risk to you as a person today. You know, my previous book was about sea level rise. We talked about that one, you know, about my book when that came out. We had a conversation on the show about it. Sea level rise has a lot of consequences to our world, including, you know, real estate values and where people are going to live and migration and all that kind of stuff. But no one's going to stand on Miami Beach and drown in real time because something, you know, an ice chunk dropped off in Greenland that afternoon, right? The risk to human life from something like sea level rise is non-existent. It's a long-term reshaping of our civilization. Heat is the exact opposite of that. It's something that can kill you now. And my book has a number of stories of people who were killed by heat stroke, by extreme heat, people who are knowledgeable about heat, even people who, you know, were experienced. It's very, very dangerous. And as we get into these higher temperatures now, it becomes more and more dangerous. So I think it's really urgent that, you know, all of us, whatever we think about the politics of climate change and energy and all that kind of stuff, we're dealing with a hotter world, and we have to understand what those risks are. And the last thing I'll say is I wanted the title to be deliberately provocative in the sense that it's about you because of me, because a lot of the writing about climate change and everything is very good, but very kind of distant. And, you know, this is something that's going to happen to our world in the future. And, you know, a lot of people think it's going to happen to somebody else who lives far away and, you know, they're sorry for them, but, you know, I'm going to be okay, they think. And this is just one of these sort of big meta problems that was sort of haunting our world. And I wanted this title to immediately announce, no, this is about you. This is about me. This is about where we live and how we live right now and the risks that we have to think about.
From hot, hot Texas, we've been speaking with American bestselling author Jeff Goodell. His new book is The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. You can find out more at jeffgoodellwriter.com, or you can download this interview free from the Radio EcoShock site at ecoshock.org. Jeff, thank you for covering the climate beat so well for so long.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Part of Greenland was ice-free not long ago, it turns out, and could go there again, raising sea level around the world. In March 2021, our guest on Radio EcoShock from the University of Vermont, Dr. Andrew Crist, explained a long-neglected Greenland ice core revealed the land surface was exposed to the sun sometime in the last 1 million years. Now the team is back with a worrying update. Part of Greenland emerged from the ice pretty recently, just 400,000 years ago. Earth was only a few tenths of a degree warmer than today. Sea levels were way higher. That looks like it could be our new future, maybe sooner than we want it. From the University of Vermont, Andrew Crist, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me, Alex.
Why do we care about what happened to Greenland ice a few 100,000 years ago?
Right. So a few 100,000 years ago seems like the distant past to you and I, but from a geologist's perspective, that's very recent. And I guess a more long-term way to think about this is how Earth's climate has generally behaved over the last 1 million years or so. So over the last 1 million years or so, Earth's climate has moved in and out of ice ages that are dictated by Earth's orbit and the geometry of the orbit around the sun. And every 100,000 years or so, we transition from being in this cold glacial period with big ice sheets covering the northern hemisphere and Antarctica with really low sea level to interglacial periods, which are slightly warmer, in some cases much warmer, with smaller ice sheets and much higher sea level. So throughout all these changes in Earth's climate over the last 1 million years or so, we want to know about times when the ice sheets that we still have left on the planet, Antarctica and Greenland, when they were actually smaller than they are today. And so one of the driving questions in the paleoclimate community is figuring out when the Greenland ice sheet was smaller than it was, because then we can identify sort of the climate conditions that allowed it to melt as we better understand what's going to happen in the future with anthropogenic climate warming.
Could you please briefly remind us why this one-of-a-kind deep drill core from Greenland was taken and how it survived from the 1960s, still intact today?
So it's a pretty miraculous story, and we have to go back a long time ago to the height of the Cold War. And so during the Cold War, the NATO allies, especially the United States, were worried about the Soviet Union firing intercontinental ballistic missiles over the Arctic Ocean. And one of the ways that the NATO allies thought of preventing that from happening was setting up all these radar stations to look for missiles coming over the Arctic. So in Greenland, which was a territory of Denmark, the U.S. government, working with the Danish government, was building these missile detection systems in northwest Greenland. And they were also doing a bunch of fundamental science experiments one of which developed into this really big project called Camp Century, where they built a what they called an Arctic research laboratory in the Greenland ice sheet, or rather in the surface of it, in the far northwest part of the island. And as part of one of the science projects at Camp Century was drilling into the ice itself to study its fundamental properties, as well as studying the climate history contained in the different layers of ice. So in the 50s, there had been some more shallow ice cores drilled in Alaska and other parts of Greenland, but there was never a deep ice core. And by deep ice core, I mean one that was drilled from the surface of an ice sheet all the way to the bottom of it where it rests on the landscape. So the Camp Century ice core was the very first one ever drilled all the way through the ice, nearly a mile thick, and then they reached the land surface at the bottom and recovered frozen soil and sediment. And so this frozen soil and sediment, which is what we studied in this project, was kind of shipped back and forth across from Greenland to the northeast United States, and then in the early 90s was actually shipped over to Denmark to the University of Copenhagen's ice core facility, where it sat really well preserved and curated, but not a whole lot was thought about it since it was brought over there. And so a few years ago, our colleagues over at the University of Copenhagen contacted us to see if we wanted to try out some analyses on this really rare sediment archive nearly 60 years after the ice core was actually collected. So it's been a pretty remarkable and serendipitous opportunity for scientists working on this project, because we've all been able to apply modern state-of-the-art techniques to a really rare sediment sample that was collected in the 1960s.
So when we talked 2 years ago, the timing of the Greenland meltback was more vague. How did you manage to narrow the date, and did the results surprise you?
Yeah, so when we previously spoke, our limiting age for this was we knew that the Greenland ice sheet must have melted significantly within the last million years. So, but that's not a really exact age. And so we used a different technique this time, which is called luminescence dating. And it's a geologic dating technique that allows us to determine the last time sediment that's buried beneath the Earth's surface was exposed to sunlight. And the new date that we got from that dating method is about 400,000 years ago. And the way that this dating method works is when you have sediment that is buried beneath the Earth's surface, there is background radiation in the soil that's really low level, but that background radiation is being released out and gathering electrons that will fill in the kind of impurities and holes inside of the crystalline atomic structure of minerals like quartz and feldspar. And over time, these electrons accumulate, and we call this a luminescent signal. And geologists can go and collect samples in the dark and then slowly dose that material with specific wavelengths of light to figure out how long and to liberate those electrons and measure them and figure out how long ago it was buried. So a useful analogy here for a more general explanation is that if you were to wear the same shirt every single day for 30 days, you would eventually accumulate a bunch of dirt and grime in between all the fibers of your shirt. And so this would be like a way for someone to look at someone who's wearing this dirty shirt and say, I know you've been wearing that for 28 days without washing it.
Scientists calling this warming around 400,000 years ago, they call it Marine Isotope Stage 11. We need a sexier name than that, but what caused that particular warming period? Do we know?
So, like I began the interview with, Earth's climate has moved in and out of these ice age cycles over the last million years or so, and they're punctuated by these warmer interglacial periods, and they're a key feature of Earth's climate over the last million years or so. And not every interglacial is the same. In fact, they're all kind of different from one another. So currently, we're living in an interglacial period called the Holocene that began about 12,000 years ago. And it's been a relatively mild and stable climate since that time. But other interglacials, like marine isotope stage 11, which was about 400,000 years ago, lasted much longer than we have experienced the interglacial today. So 400,000 years ago, Earth's climate was moving out of a really intense glacial period where there were very large ice sheets covering the northern hemisphere in Antarctica. And there was kind of a feedback system where the big ice sheets, and once they started to retreat as Earth's orbit around the sun triggered the end of the ice age, kind of shifted it into a really warm state. But what was unique about that time in Earth's climate is that the way that the Earth was orbiting around the sun was in a specific way that it that this warm period lasted for 30,000 years. And the duration of that interglacial period 400,000 years ago is what we think allowed large portions of the Greenland ice sheet to melt and raise sea level.
Well, just for listener reference, there were no Homo sapiens like us 400,000 years ago. The first Neanderthals were moving into Europe, though, and there were animals and parts of Greenland were actually green. How much warmer was it compared to today?
That's right. No Homo sapien hominids, but plenty of our ancestors from the branches of the hominids were around at that time. And globally, temperatures during MIS 11 were about 1 to 2 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial values. So that's we're in within that range right now as we've warmed the climate through burning fossil fuels. You know, it's kind of a useful analog for what the climate is capable of and what how certain elements of the climate system, like ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica, may respond to prolonged, relatively mild, warm temperatures.
Well, this is one of the scary things about your team's discovery. Some experts now predict Earth will be 1.5 degrees C hotter than pre-industrial as early as 2035. I'd still, though, presume it would take, what, thousands of years to lose enough ice for some of Greenland's surface to begin to appear again, or what?
So you're right. This is a scary implication of our work, is that not that much warmer temperatures in the past were capable of melting the Greenland ice sheet. And, the really key part of our finding is that it was relatively mild warm temperatures for a very long time. And what we need to worry about as a global society is that we have emitted all of these greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And of those, carbon dioxide has a long residence time in the atmosphere, meaning it's going to stay up there, keeping the climate warm for thousands, maybe tens of thousands of years, until it's geologically sequestered back into the Earth's crust. And so that long duration of warming, you know, could threaten the stability of the Greenland ice sheet in the coming centuries and the coming millennia. And I know it's really difficult for us as humans to think hundreds of years or thousands of years into the future, because we can at most maybe think a couple of years into the future in our own lives. But that's the scary thing to think about, is if, you know, mild, warm temperatures for a long time melted the ice sheet in the past, then what will it mean for rapid warming right now that could last for thousands of years into the future? And I guess the last thing I'd say about how long it would take to melt significant portions of the ice sheet is that there's ice sheet modeling, so numerical computer models of how Greenland may respond to climate change in the future in its configuration and geometry and how it may raise sea level. And, you know, under worst-case emission scenarios, we could lose a few meters of sea level equivalent from Greenland in a couple of centuries. And there's even some models that suggest under the worst-case scenarios of emissions that we could lose the entire ice sheet, or 7.3 meters or over 22 feet of sea level rise equivalent in the next 1,000 years. So there's a lot of unknowns in what may happen to the Greenland ice sheet, how it may actually respond to warming of the atmosphere as well as warming of ocean currents around the island. But it is certainly concerning that we could lose a lot of that ice in the relatively near future.
So is this deglaciation on Greenland a tipping point situation where enough warming starts a process that is irreversible? Once it starts, you can't stop it?
For our specific study, I actually don't think it is necessarily a tipping point result. And the reason I think that is because it's this long duration of warm temperatures that melted the ice sheet. And so an analogy that I think might be useful is if you're at a summer barbecue and you have a cooler full of drinks with ice in it, if you, you know, open the cooler up on a 95-degree day and you leave it open for maybe 10 minutes, probably not going to melt very much of the ice. But if you leave the cooler open for 2 hours, you're going to melt a lot of that ice in the cooler. And so it's really that not a, you know, a tipping point thing. It's really just you let ice sit out in the warmth for a long time, it's going to melt.
I presume there are a host of other impacts. If and when more of Greenland surfaces to the daylight, the missing ice will reflect less solar energy back into space. Could it also change ocean currents or even the mass balance of the planet?
Yeah, absolutely. So sea level is really the most direct way that we can evaluate impacts to the climate system. But you're right, as you reflect less sunlight from the Greenland ice sheet into the atmosphere, more of that solar radiation is retained in the atmosphere, and the melting of the ice sheet itself could interrupt ocean currents, specifically Atlantic meridional overturning currents or circulation in the North Atlantic. But another aspect of a climate feedback or consequence of the melting of the Greenland ice sheet is that the ecosystems that are present in the areas of Greenland that are deglaciated could change. So right now in Greenland, most of the ice-free areas are inhabited by tundra and very short shrubbery. And what we're seeing in Arctic Canada and parts of Arctic Siberia and Russia is that we're seeing a shift from tundra ecosystems to some boreal forest ecosystems, as well as melting of permafrost. So these changes in what's going on in these ecosystems can also shift or change the carbon cycle. And we don't know exactly how that may proceed, but it could impact how much carbon is actually retained in the Arctic or emitted back into the atmosphere. So there's a host of different, you know, other cascading effects of the melting of the Greenland ice sheet that are quite complicated to figure out, but are possible in a warmer future.
Drew Christ, you also traveled to Antarctica, I believe, to study glaciers. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And is there a similar deep core that would reveal when the last time parts of Antarctica were there without an ice covering?
So Greenland and Antarctica, although they're both covered by ice sheets, are quite different places. The ice sheet in Greenland has been there, we think, for about 2.6 million years in terms of, like, there's been large ice sheets covering it. There's been times when it's been smaller, but for the most part, it's been there. Antarctica has been around for a much longer amount of time. In most places, about 13 million years, at least in East Antarctica. Drilling through the Antarctic ice sheet to recover sediment from the bottom is more challenging because the ice there is so thick. But there are some projects that are going on around Antarctica to figure out really old climate. And it's being done by American project teams, the European community, as well as the Australians and other nations. And some of those projects are attempting to recover sediment from the bottom of the Antarctic ice sheet in East Antarctica that might tell them the last time that it was deglaciated, but that's still a work in progress. The other half of Antarctica, which is West Antarctica, is another different aspect of the Antarctic ice sheet compared to Greenland, in that West Antarctica is what we call a marine ice sheet, meaning that the bottom of the ice sheet actually rests on the seafloor, in some places as much as 2 kilometers below sea level. So recovering sediments from the bottom of that ice sheet can tell you slightly different information in terms of when the last time there was just ocean water there instead of an ice sheet. And there's been some work done on that in West Antarctica that tells us about changes in where the ice sheet was over the last 10,000 years. But to my knowledge, there's no ability from recovering sediment cores from beneath that ice sheet right now that go back hundreds of thousands of years.
Our guest, Dr. Andrew Crist, is Gunn Postdoctoral Fellow and lecturer at the University of Vermont in Burlington. His latest paper with UVM Lab Director Paul Bierman and 17 other authors is titled Deglaciation of Northwestern Greenland During Marine Isotope Stage 11. That is in the journal Science, published July 20th, 2023. You can find more in links and news to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Drew, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Of course. Thanks so much for your great questions, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Nobody reports from Greenland except Denmark-based glaciologist Jason Box. You're about to hear a few minutes from his YouTube update posted on July 23rd, 2023.
Hey, everybody. Jason Box here. I want to make this short video to describe the record-setting temperatures that Greenland is getting July 2023. And this is at a time when global average temperatures are off the charts, caused by the El Nino ejecting that excess heat that the oceans have been taking up. Remember that 95% of the planetary energy imbalance from too much greenhouse gases, it's accumulating in the oceans. The oceans are really the big story about climate because, again, most of the energy is being absorbed by the oceans. Now, in the El Nino, it comes out, and we're seeing that here with these shocking new records just smashed globally. And the other part of the story is that we're at an all-time high for greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere. So this global warming thing is very clear in this graphic. And we're seeing the consequences of this with extreme climate events that are just kind of daily now. But to focus on Greenland, we need to consider the North Atlantic. There have been record high temperatures. The typical pattern for sea surface temperatures has been a cold anomaly south of Greenland. This has been persistent, and here in the 100-year temperature trend, the only place on the planet that has been cooling is south of Greenland. This cold blob has to do with changing ocean circulations and probably the excess freshwater from melting Greenland and Arctic Canada flooding the North Atlantic, contributing to this disruption. But here we are today with the marine heat wave south of Greenland. That combined with the flow from the extremely warm North America, it's dragging that heat up to Greenland. It's picking up some heat from the oceans, and that's part of Greenland's melt story this year. To see melting wet snow conditions across the whole southern ice sheet is remarkable. There's even some wet snow being picked up by this satellite measurement here in what we call the dry snow area. These are the count of the melt days, and notice how there's only a narrow area of the dry snow area that has not yet had melting this year. And the southern ice sheet here, which really has high elevations, I'll talk about more, to have melting across the southern ice sheet is remarkable. Just a few weeks ago, we also had record melting conditions across North Greenland, but the story so far this year has really shifted to the south, the southern ice sheet melting. For the whole of Greenland, you can see 2023 here in the red line, and that is rivaling the 2012 extreme melting. On this date, we're ranked second for melting after 2012. And notice how the melt area has been around 1 million square kilometers for perhaps more time than in 2012. So again, we're rivaling the melting conditions at the surface in 2023, rivaling 2012. So we can bring in some of our automatic weather station data here. This place called Dai 2, that's 6,960 feet above sea level, so high on the southwestern ice sheet. I installed the original station in 1996, and we managed to keep this equipment running for that many years. 2023, round-the-clock melting several days in July. To have melting at nighttime, the sun does dip near the horizon here on the Arctic Circle, and to have melting at kind of midnight is remarkable. South Dome, higher in elevation, this is 9,490 feet we had round-the-clock melting around the 8th of July this year. Max temperatures 6.5 Celsius. That's extreme. And so we'll have a closer look at July 8th of this year when that was the warmest day. This South Dome location is very memorable because I installed this station in 1997. And we've managed to keep these measurements running. And there have been problems, though. And you can see here, 20 years later, the station's just getting hammered. It's a extreme climate up there, 9,000 feet above sea level, high winds, and a lot of snow. So the challenge is to keep the equipment from being buried. We have to extend these stations every year or two. South Dome, I'm just dwelling on here because that's really where the July 2023 melt anomaly is focused. So these are so-called melting degree days. It's the sum of air temperatures above 0 Celsius, and we have 2023 at record high melting degree days, higher than 2012. And you can see we've got some data gaps here. We know that 2010 was also a very warm year, so that may be up here. But as you can see, 2023 is extremely high temperature for South Dome. So Xavier Fettweis is calculating the so-called surface mass balance. That's the balance of snowfall and meltwater runoff. And for this small, or this area of South Greenland, it's not that small, this green area, the surface mass balance is record low. So the ice sheet has been in mass budget deficit throughout the year when you add these up day by day. And so again, the story for 2023 seems to be so far focused in South Greenland. And so I look here at the integrated water vapor transport. This is precipitable water. It's the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere. And around the 8th of July 2023, it's pretty interesting. So here in the water vapor transport, you'll notice the atmospheric river coming on the 6th of July this year and hitting central West Greenland. We're going to look at precipitation measurements from our weather station network. And notice how South Dome is dry. And that stays like this. So the across South Greenland, it's dry during this period around the 8th of July when, again, this atmospheric river hits central West Greenland and it's delivering rainfall. Here at Dai 2 station, again, pretty high on the ice sheet. There's 30 millimeters of rainfall in July of this year. At Saddle, even higher, this is like 8,400 feet above sea level, we have more than 10 millimeters of rain. The rain is really coming on the 6th, 7th of July at Dai 2. And Swiss Camp, further north, the rain's coming on the 7th, 8th, 30 millimeters. And that's continued this month. These hourly data are updated to present. There's only a 10-minute latency on these data, so these data are very fresh up through the recording of this video on the 22nd of July. Jar and Swiss Camp. So Jar is 15 kilometers lower on the ice sheet than Swiss Camp, and you'll see similar spike in rainfall, up to 40 millimeters of rain. Looks like about 25 millimeters of rain, an inch of rain in a day at this location at 69.5 north in the Arctic on the Western Greenland ice sheet.
That was glaciologist Jason Box reporting from Greenland. Find links to his regular video updates on YouTube in my show blog at ecoshock.org. As Antonio Guterres said at the start, we are totally out of time. Please listen next week for that new science on the Atlantic currents and when it might collapse, sending the UK and Northern Europe into the cold house, even as the rest of the planet warms. Strange days. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
The global sea surface temperature climbed to unprecedented highs for the month of June. According to the Copernicus, driving localized marine heat waves across the planet, including around the UK and Ireland, the Baltic Sea, the Sea of Japan, the Pacific Ocean off New Zealand, and the Western Indian Ocean close to Madagascar. The heat waves are expected to become more frequent, more intense, and last longer as the climate crisis, caused by burning fossil fuels, continues to worsen.